I feel like we're getting really sophisticated in circular economy. We're appreciating the problem is the iceberg and don't just look at the top. So I love that panel for reinforcing design for change. Let's really understand the iceberg. Okay, you guys are super keen. Keeping on, we're on to measuring circular economy, which we can't do anything unless we know the problem and we know how to measure it. So our experts are going to share the latest on national research and action on circularity metrics. This session is going to cover key indicators, measurement tools, and benchmarks essential for evaluating impact and efficiency of circular practices. I'm really going to hand over to Heinz, who was instrumental in getting Jan's Potocnik.
Yeah.
I keep saying S, and my Croatian girlfriend yelled at me last night. So anyway, to get Jan's here, I'll do that. And so thank you for leading this panel on metrics and introducing our key panelists.
Sure. Yeah, thanks very much. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure being here. My name is Heinz Schandl. I'm the Circular Economy Lead at the CSIRO. We have Kat Heinrich with us from Rawtech in Adelaide, South Australia. We also have Kate Noble from Sustainability Victoria in Melbourne. And we have Ben van Velden, who is with Deloitte, also based in Melbourne. I have an interesting role here. I was asked to give a bit of a presentation, but I don't want to take too much time off our panelists, so we'll see how we do that. This should be an iconic picture now, which are the material flows in the Australian economy. And there are only a few things we really need to focus on, which is the very large amount that we extract, the significant amount that we get out of the door immediately through our exports without many value adding. The about 900 million tons of domestic material consumption that we manage in our domestic economy, and the 39 million tons that we recover and use for a second time, which gives us our circularity rate. We can also take a footprint perspective, which now positions the Australian economy within global supply chains. And so the responsibility of the waste that has occurred, the primary materials that were needed to create our imports, is now attributed to our indicator, to our material footprint indicator. And that means our 100 million tons that we directly import have now grown to 300 million tons, because this is stuff that was needed to produce our inputs, our final demand. But also our exports have now grown, because all the mining waste, the agricultural waste that has been incurred in order to get stuff to other countries is now attributed to others. And we can see how this material is used for important things, like the way we are housed, the way how we get around, our energy system, our food supply. So these are the provision systems which you see here, and you see their impact. And when you take four of those provision systems together, mobility, housing, energy, and food, it's already 80% of our environmental pressure and impact. In the national framework, in the Measuring What Matters framework of the Treasury, we now have three new indicators: the circularity rate, the material footprint, and resource productivity. They're all significant. The circularity rate measures the amount of material that we recover compared to the amount of material that we manage. So the 39 million tons divided by the about 900 million tons that we measure gives a circularity of about anywhere between 4 and 5%. The material footprint is our responsibility for primary material extraction in the global economy, wherever the material comes from. Resource productivity is the amount of dollars that we press out of every kilogram of material that we use in the Australian economy. So you want a high circularity rate, a low material footprint, and a really high material productivity. So I'm looking here at an experiment where we compare three economies that are very different: Australia, Japan, and the Netherlands. Japan is the front runner in the circular economy. They started to introduce the three R's to the international policy community through the G7 and the G20 process. Netherlands is the poster child. The circularity rates are very different: 4% in Australia, 20% in Japan, about 30% in the Netherlands. What if we phase out fossil fuels, which we have to do? How would that influence the circularity rate in the three countries? It would do almost nothing in Australia. And the reason is because we recover every bit of coal ash at the moment, which adds to our circularity rate. It would make a massive impact in the Netherlands because of how they organize their energy system. A little bit of impact in Japan. But we could recover all the waste that goes to landfill. So what if every kilogram that goes to landfill would now be recycled, brought back into the process? It would increase our circularity rate by 1%. Not much impact in Japan. Japan has this principle, recycle everything and then burn the rest. So this would not make a difference. A little bit of difference in the Netherlands, not substantial. So recycling is not key. I'm not saying let's not do all the recycling we can do, because there are many good reasons for doing that, but it's not making a large difference. If we could recycle 5% of mining waste, bring it back into the process, like, for example, red mud or other material into road base, that would make some difference in the Australian economy. A little bit of difference or almost no difference in Japan and the Netherlands. If we did all of this together, if we combine all these different actions, so we phased out fossil fuels, we're now recycling every kilogram of material that goes to landfill, and we're also recycling a small amount of mining waste, 5%. Now we've doubled Australia's circularity rate. The Netherlands are now 60% circular. And the way we measure this, as I said before, is the recycled material, the material we bring back, compared to the material that we manage. But what if we would use another base? What if we would say there are always countries that are going to extract the resources that everyone in the global economy needs? There will be countries who do the mining, who do the agricultural production. What if we use the material footprint, our responsibility, as the denominator in the circularity rate? And the result that you would get is Australia would then be 13% circular. But the circularity in the other two countries would massively drop, because now the materials that sit in our budget, in our indicator, are moved to where they actually created the benefit. What that tells you is the global economy can be anywhere between 15 and 20% circular. And what that also means is we cannot just look at the third R, the recycle. We need to look at reduce at the start of the process. So we need to reduce our material footprint. And then at the same time, we need to start reusing the material. And that's why we really need these three indicators. At the front end, the material footprint, which need to decline. Then in the middle, resource productivity. We need to use things more often, more frequently, for longer. And then at the end of the process, the recycling that we achieve. And so the circularity rate is then the top figure, which brings it all together. So that's really all I wanted to say at the beginning, to put a bit of context around the numbers we're dealing here with. And with that, I would like to now head over to our panel. And I first invite you, Kat, to talk about your experience in measuring progress of our circular economy.
Thank you very much, Heinz, and congratulations on that work. It really is interesting. I guess one of the points I want to make today is that metrics serve different purposes. So the work that Heinz does a really great job of the macro trends. It tells us how circular are we, what's our potential, and I think it's really valuable in terms of being able to track that over time to see how we as a country are progressing. What I would like to focus on is looking at metrics that can help guide and accelerate Australia's transition towards a circular economy. And to do this, I think it's really important that metrics have two elements in place. Number one, they need to be value-based. And number two, they need to be integrated into frameworks that drive tangible action. So those, I just keep that in mind, and I'll talk about those two points now. So element number one, values-based metrics. We have to remember that we're not transitioning to the circular economy for the sake of the circular economy. As Matt Keane said in his keynote today, it's about reducing carbon emissions, is about creating jobs, is about regenerating the natural environment. So we need to keep that in mind. Now, the challenge is if we only focus on metrics that look at material flows and volumes of material, we lack insights on which actions are going to drive the biggest impact. I'll give you an example. Landfill diversion, the old classic, put up your hand if you're where you live, your state tracks landfill diversion. Oh, come on. It's a lot more than that. It's most states in Australia. And, you know, it is a popular statistic. And I'm not poo-pooing landfill diversion. It is a useful metric for some cases. But the challenge is that with landfill diversion is that it doesn't differentiate between higher order strategies like reuse and lower order strategies like recycling. So, of course, where we land is that the benefits of reuse, for example, go unquantified and undervalued. So to fill this gap, we at RawTech have worked with Charitable Reuse Australia and the New South Wales EPA to look at quantifying the triple bottom line impacts of reuse. And shout out to Kirsten from Reverse Garbage here in the room, who was heavily involved in that project. And what we found through this project is that by reusing instead of recycling, we can generate 25 times the number of jobs on a per ton basis. And substantial greenhouse gas emissions savings. If we take textiles alone, we can save 30 times the amount of emissions compared to recycling. So hence why it's really important to have values-based metrics when making decisions on which actions are going to help us move towards a circular economy. The second element that I think is really important to this type of metrics is to be able to embed metrics in frameworks that drive tangible action. So I'm talking about things like regulation, incentives, this type of thing. And two examples of this is, well, first of all, if we look at the built environment over to the example in Denmark, they've actually introduced regulation that requires builders to start to measure the carbon and the embodied carbon in buildings. And they've gone a step further to say, we're actually going to have limits on how much carbon is allowed in new buildings. So this is going to drive the transition towards more circular buildings. One more example from the food systems is looking at Tesco. So Tesco in the UK, they're committed to reducing their food waste. And they're actually linking achievement of those targets to executive bonuses. So you're not going to get your full executive bonus unless we help reduce food waste. So I think these are really powerful examples of how we can use metrics in a way to really accelerate and guide Australia's transition to a circular economy. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Kat. We're moving to you, Kate. So I think you're using data and metrics a lot. And for what purpose? How do you do that? And how does that help you?
So I'm going to build on a theme here. Thanks, Kat. And just to introduce my role a little at Sustainability Victoria, my role is to sort of generate new ideas by collaborating with industry, across government, and with the research community. So my understanding is most of the people here are in one of those three, and of course we're all members of the community. So my question is, what metrics are meaningful for those different groups and how we use them? So we've got the global picture presented by Hines, and some of the research we do, it gets into more of the community picture or the industry transition picture. And I've got a couple of examples to share with you. So releasing tomorrow our State of Sustainability report that will be on Sustainability Victoria's website. It actually is a statewide survey of community attitudes to various topics in sustainability, including the circular economy. So one of the reasons that we like to measure things is to compare ourselves with others. And communities are the same. They want to know which regions are tracking against which indicators. And it also provides examples of where there's market potential for various businesses. So 80% of Victorians would prefer to buy products that can be service repaired or that work for longer. 78%, when they're purchasing a new product, are considering how long a product lasts, how easy it is to repair, and 47% are willing to pay more for products easily repurposed or recyclable at the end of life. However, the challenge is only 34% of people are familiar with the term circular economy, although that's an increase of 8%. So there's the market potential and also a challenge. So we can use indicators in that way, or we can look at a specific industry sector. There was a great pitch earlier today on recycling solar panels. We've been doing some research on the renewable energy transition and opportunities for a circular economy in the materials needed for that transition. In collaboration with ClimateWorks and the Clean Energy Council, we've quantified the materials needed for renewable energy infrastructure out to 2050. It's a lot of concrete, glass, steel, as you'd expect, battery chemicals, aluminium, nickel. And these materials are available for a second life, and there's huge potential there. The average solar panel, the lifespan is 21 years. And more than 4.7 million solar panels will be decommissioned by 2035 in Victoria alone. So that gives you a sense of the scale of that potential. When batteries reach the end of their life, in electric vehicles, they still retain 70 to 80% of their original battery storage capacity. So there's an opportunity to extend the life and repurpose those. However, the challenge is the jobs and skills needed to make the most of this potential. How do we measure those? It's not just about the number of jobs, as any economist will tell you and many business leaders. It's a real challenge finding skilled workers in the current economy. So it's not only about the creation of jobs, it's about what skills are needed for the current workforce. And so some of the research that we're doing is looking at, well, what is the potential for circular economy skills from an economic perspective? And the good news is, in the same way that we're adding value or making sure that we're retaining the value of materials through a circular economy, the skills needed for a circular economy workforce are higher levels of skills, which means higher pay, good quality jobs, and increase to productivity. So I'll leave it there, but wanted to give you a little bit of colour and texture on the kinds of measures that are important for policymakers, and I hope also for various industry people and researchers in the room.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks. So there's a lot of use of data in policy at every stage in the policy cycle, if you like, you know, from recognizing a problem to framing it as a policy issue in the implementation and then obviously measuring and monitoring. But how about the business community, Ben? What kind of data are they using there? And maybe you even want to share some of your thinking about the global circularity protocol.
Yeah, thanks, okay. Heinz. So I think through the lens of my role in the business of Deloitte, working with the agri-food sector particularly, and trying to apply the principles of circularity to one of the global leading emitters from an industry perspective, we've really found our clients have been most challenged by how do we measure how circular we are in a way that drives real value for decision making in our businesses. The material flows are important, and the level of waste that we want to reduce is, you know, clearly a value driver for us. The amount of recycling we're doing is very important, but the challenge, the biggest challenge, is how do we accelerate the collaboration through a value chain? So thinking beyond what an individual business is doing with an individual product, looking at ways that value chain partners are making better choices around circular business models to actually reduce the use of a resource in the first place. And so businesses looking for metrics that allow them to get the recognition for the effort they make to stop using a resource as much as they are getting the recognition for the recovery of a resource. And I think that has been one of the key motivations to the global circularity protocol work that is going on with the World Business Council for Sustainable Development and UN One Planet Initiative, is to try and find those ways that recognize the more holistic components of circularity that businesses are participating in, where they're working with value chain partners. And the really, I think, aha moment for most organizations leaning into circularity that we work with is they can't be circular on their own. Therefore, they need to collaborate. Therefore, they need to work out how do they measure the impact of that collaboration and participation. It is a team sport. And so how do you reward those that are contributing to outcomes that might have the greater effect in a node outside of their business? So that's one of the big complexities, I think, Hines, that we're seeing. And then I think the probably the last thing that business starts to really get challenged by is if they need to share data in that process, how do we make sure there's the right protocols around security and trust around the use of that data for its intended purpose? And how do we deal with the challenge that we're trying to accelerate collaboration? Yet we've got this massive amount of energy coming from regulators around restricting sort of anti-competitive activity, which is, I think, a real handbrake for sustainability and circularity at this early stage and what business is trying to achieve. And so the last thing I'll just say is next week, another report, which I'd commend to you, is coming out called The Lucky Country, Transforming Australia into a climate smart food superpower. And it spotlights the critical role of circularity and thinking beyond the borders of Australia and how we work, to your point, Hines, at a whole global level on measuring material activity and decarb reduction through the supply chain.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Ben. I do have a few pre-prepared questions in case that you don't have any questions, but you do have questions. So I think what we do is I'll go through some of your questions, although some of the questions I really don't understand well what they mean. Never mind. But send us lots of questions. Then we can actually tailor that to what you want to know rather than what I would have asked. And so the first question is for you, Kat. And it's a tricky one, I think.
Ooh.
Because it's about the Neighbours scheme in Australia, which is about embodied emissions. And the question is, how is this different or compared to what they're doing in Denmark? And what can we expect the impact to be in the Australian property industry?
Oh, that's a really specific question. So I can't comment in terms of not knowing the details of the Neighbours system, apart from the fact that they're setting up a standard for embodied emissions. I'll just make the comment, though, that obviously, you know, if you're part of the Neighbours, you're getting that accreditation, which is a nice incentive. So it aligns with what I was talking about before, the importance of linking metrics to incentives. I think where it differs from Denmark, to my understanding, is it's regulated. Like, you need to meet certain emissions, maximum emissions per square metre. So where I would like to see it head in Australia is to move from the great work that Neighbours has done to actually move to a mandated system.
Yeah. If anyone wants to jump in, does anyone want to jump in? Or are you happy not to?
I think the Denmark link is something I'd like to do there, Hines. And it goes to thinking at a country level. And obviously the built environment's a fundamental part of that, but coming back to my favourite topic, food, that country is coming out with voluntary climate labelling on food products for products produced in Denmark and imported and sold in Denmark, i.e. Australian food and beverages that we send there, as of next year, with a national level attributed LCSA across core different products. So whether you're measuring your own product or not, retailers will step in and range your product and classify it by an emission intensity perspective. So that's happening at a food level. Why? Because that's the choice consumers make every day. We don't build a house every day, but you can see that discipline coming back down into regularly procured resources that is driven in support by industry, delivered as a voluntary option, moving towards mandatory adoption.
And I would just like to give a shout out to Maria Atkinson, who's sitting in the corner over here. Maria set up the Green Building Council quite a few years ago. And in a way, what we're doing on circular economy and thinking about metrics and the role that that kind of transparency and comparison between buildings or sectors, what that does is it enables the market to compete. And in a way, the work that the Green Building Council did all those foundational years ago, we're kind of in that foundational phase now. And so we can see how metrics and that kind of transparency and accountability can really help shift things over time. I don't know if you'd like to comment, Maria, but I wanted to shout out to you.
Fantastic. But if you want to say something, we're very happy for you to do that. If you want to, you have a microphone for you.
Thank you, Heinz. Thank you for that, Kate. That's very beautiful of you. It was a very long time ago, 25 years ago, 26 years ago, so I'm very old. But the important thing, I think, is that we're starting to, I love this conversation about linking metrics to incentives and understanding metrics, but I think we have to think about it, and the focus here is circularity, but there's elements within that and the accountability and transparency. So I just did a quick post on LinkedIn with a methodology that's just like value-added tax or GST, but it's around carbon, and it's about getting it. If you've got a service or a product, you're accounting for the carbon in a standardized global way, because you're going to have the European Union with the carbon border tax coming in. But it's actually grounding it in a global accounting, boring but important, standard. So I think that the world is recognizing exactly what this beautiful panel has been saying, is we've got to get it at the granular level and then work it up and link it to policy and incentives. So I've really loved the conversation. Thank you.
Fantastic. So we make this very interactive. As you can see, if you want to come up, you can do that as well. But we do have a question for the panel first, which is what types of corporate circularity targets would the panel like to see by 2030, 2040 and beyond? Be specific.
Wow. Well, first of all, you can't reach an outcome. You can't score a goal unless you have a target, right? So I think we do need them, Heinz. We've been, you know, comfortable being uncomfortable setting emission reduction targets. And I actually think we should be working harder to step forward with circularity targets as well. From my experience, when businesses do that, and develop the right sort of framework for measurement in collaboration with their supply chain partners, they create immense value for themselves and for their supply chain partners. And the example I'd call out is Royal Swinkels Brewery in the Netherlands, which did exactly that, started with CTI, applied it in a bit more of a simple and effective method for grain and malt barley suppliers into their business. And together they became more profitable, and together they created products that could be differentiated at the retail point. So if you are bold enough to set a target and you know you can't be circular on your own, then you inspire others to try and work with you and enjoy the spoils of that path as well. So I'm all for businesses setting circularity targets and measuring it and reporting on it, just like they're beginning to do in the Northern Hemisphere.
Kat, I'm sure you want to jump in.
Well, no, I was just going to say, I think complementary to this, I'm not talking about the specific target, but I'd like to see transparency of reporting too. And I know there's like a call for it in the UK with the food companies. They want businesses to have to actually, you know, transparently report the amount of food waste they generate. I would love to see more transparency around that to support, you know, it's one thing to have a target, but yet the reporting is really important too, and being transparent about that is super important. And I'd also say that there's not one target for corporate. It just depends on what sector you're in. So it's a little bit more nuanced than that. For the food sector, obviously food waste is a key one. It's at the top of the hierarchy. Avoiding food waste is such an essential one. I'd like to see transparency of reporting around halving food waste by 2030. For other products like consumer goods, I'd like to see targets around longevity of products. I think that's really important. It really depends on which sector you're looking at.
We jump to a different question. And I'd like to preamble the question a little bit. So the question will be about, will measuring for circular economy be included in mandated climate reporting? But the way I'm thinking about it as well is, very quickly, when we talk about the circular economy, we go to the embodied carbon emission and to the climate story, which is such a dominant story anyway. But are we forgetting other aspects of the way how we use materials in the economic process and the environmental implications, whether it's biodiversity loss, pollution, resource depletion, or a climate, which you could say are all symptoms of the way how we have organized the economic process? So what's the view of the panel in that regard? Do you want to start, Kate?
I feel like that was an invitation and that you've been reading my mind.
Absolutely.
And what I was thinking on that last topic is, you know, there's some things we can measure and we can report on it, but there's other things that are really important that we can't measure. And of those, some of them we can't measure yet and we need to do more research, and others are really intangible, but they're still really important. And so how do we not get too caught up in the purity of the data collection and the measurement and the thrill of spreadsheets? I know I'm not alone.
No, you're not.
And wanting to, you know, get that comprehensive picture of everything we can measure and feel a sense of, I don't know, control that we're managing a transition and that we're managing transition risk. When we know that particularly with biodiversity, there's so many data gaps, and we could tell ourselves that we can use the environmental accounts. I know I'm walking on thin ice here with you, Heinz, but we could tell ourselves that we could do a supply chain biodiversity analysis looking at input-output tables and environmental accounts. But what is that going to mean to an actual koala? Or, you know, a possum that needs an old tree in a tree hollow in a specific place. And I think that's where we've still got quite a lot of data gaps, and we need to be careful that we're not getting so caught up in the genius of the sort of more abstract models that we can use with the ground truthing needed to make it meaningful. So I'd say that's a real challenge.
Totally get that. Beside the fact we don't know what koalas and other things thinking about anyway, but man, what's your thought?
I think one of the things that I agree behind is that, you know, the regulatory driven focus on reporting for climate has really matured the discussion at the director level, which is really important because, you know, business can't survive in a changing climate environment unless you've got amazing strategies. But you also can't survive without nature as well, right? We all depend on it. But when you, one of the challenges with measuring circularity through a material lens is it doesn't give any credit to the social fabric that you're enabling as well. And business only exists because it's supported by society, right? Like we have businesses, they have a presence. It's a place you go to spend most of your day, but you're part of a community, and the choices you make to become more circular might lead to job creation, value creation in that region, which is not in your P&L, it's not in your balance sheet. So I think the complexity of measuring circularity that really recognizes societal benefit is that sort of holistic value balancing challenge that we need to bring in. And that's what makes places special, because each place values the components, the attributes of what's special about their region uniquely. So we need that capability to recognize the role of industry, business, but the spillover of what they do for community is going to be really, really important, as well as environment.
Yeah. Let me add something, Kat, before you come in. There's a question which goes, how do we bring our circular metrics to a planetary boundary scale that aligns with Janusz's presentation yesterday? Still on the same topic, but now a bit.
I wasn't there yesterday, so I won't comment on this one.
But you have heard about the planetary boundaries.
Of course, of course.
Just go with the planetary boundaries.
Roll with it. So how does it align with that? So I don't know, Heinz, what's your ideas?
Okay. Anyone else from the panel? We want the panel to shine.
We were having an earlier conversation over breakfast just as the coffee kicked in where we did get a bit philosophical. And so if we're talking about planetary boundaries, and we've already tried to put ourselves in the shoes of koalas and possums and realizing, yes, they don't wear shoes. I think something we should keep in mind is, you know, what are the limits? Are we talking about a limit to growth when we talk about a circular economy? Or are we talking about increasing economic activity decoupled from the natural resources that are needed to sustain life on Earth? See, I did get philosophical. And I think that decoupling we've already seen, and we can already see with the energy transition, and the exciting opportunity that we have in the room is to work out how do we do that with the natural materials. And even calling them natural materials as a resource, we're talking about nature. We are talking about something far more profound than just natural materials. We all know that. And we have the opportunity, I think, as we include First Peoples perspectives in thinking about seven generations before us, seven generations after us. If we are thinking about a genuine stewardship role, we've got a lot to learn from First Peoples in relation to caring for country. And I think it's something we can reflect on as well.
I guess as well, just to add to that is, yes, we can decouple our resource use from economic growth, but there is a real limit. So we can't just keep growing. Even if we decouple, we're still going to be using some resources. So then there are natural limits, and we need to respect those. We need to save land and put that aside for biodiversity. We can't just, you know, go on this perpetual growth cycle. There are limits. And just going back to the earlier question about biodiversity, yes, it is complex to measure. And I think it's useful to think about proxies. So, for example, you know, how much land has been returned to the natural environment, has been regenerated, et cetera. I think we need to start thinking about these types of measures, which are certainly not perfect, but they can form part of the suite of measures that we can use.
Yeah. Now, it feels like you have heard Janusz's presentation yesterday, because he talked about consumption and the importance not just to think about eco-efficiency in the production process, but also what are we doing in consumption and how does that then vary across different country income groups, where some countries have to grow, but others have to make space for that to happen. Do you want to comment on that, Ben?
I just probably link to Kate's comment about the wisdom of First Nations people when I was thinking about our breakfast conversation and when did we come to circularity. And for me, it was being part of a group called the Tohono Movement, which means in Māori to connect. And it was in 2011, 24 business leaders went to Stanford D School to have a discussion about the future of food and agriculture for New Zealand. And we had this amazing leader who represented the Māori Lands Trust. And the challenge that we were given was, what's the one word that you could use to uniquely define the contribution that New Zealand makes to the global food system? And that has to be unique. So use the indigenous language. And the word was kaitiakitanga, which ultimately means that you're the custodian of the natural environment. And when you pass on that custodianship to the next generation, it's your job to make sure it's in a better condition than what you inherited. And like those core principles of not abusing and using nature, but working with it to get outcomes, achieve growth, but do it in a way that leaves it for the next generation to survive and thrive. So fundamental, right? And it just, I think that if we have that mindset and how we act in all of our roles, but in business particularly, like how are we doing that? Or what are the choices that we can make every day?
Yep.
And that's where our procurement teams play such a fundamental role, I think, in helping mature us in that space.
Mm. So we do have a carbon budget. Do we need a material budget as well?
Isn't that what your slides were?
I'm asking you. I'm not the expert.
I think I think, as well as that global picture, then it is about how do we downscale it so that you know, we don't get too caught up in the tactical work that we're doing, you know, as businesses or with specific programs, but we are linking it to that overall outcome. I think that that is really important. Otherwise, we're doing activity, but we're not really achieving a circular economy.
I think if you value anything, you start to measure it. And so whether it's carbon or material consumption, you know, carbon equals cost. And that's why governments and businesses are fixated by it, because if you can reduce it, remove it from your production system and have your own sourced renewable energy, then you've taken a cost out, which was a procured power source, for example. So that's a fundamental motivation. And if you think about every material you use or give away or turn a blind eye to and you didn't realize you were losing, that's just wasteful use of resources. So 100%, Hines, we need to think about how do we make that measurement of the full spectrum of a resource life cycle easier, because it's not easy, and that's the barrier to a lot of people engaging with it sooner, I think.
I guess if we are going to have a material budget, we've got to, I think it'd be tricky to do that as a nation. And I think if we are going to do things like this with policy making, we need to bring it back to the businesses, you know, the suppliers of tyres, for example, or, you know, whatever materials. And we need to go, we need to take a systems approach and even go beyond that and go, you know, talking about tyres and mobility, how do we actually allow mobility in society, enable that? And here's our budget. So that doesn't favour a certain mode of mobility, but it's an outcomes focused. I think we kind of need that bigger picture systems lens as well.
Yep.
I think we've got a helpful parallel, actually, in what we've learned with greenhouse gas accounting over the decades, where, you know, we can go around in circles, you know, making category mistakes as to are we talking about direct impacts or supply chain impacts. And we've already been through that journey with direct greenhouse gas emissions and indirect greenhouse gas emissions, talking about your scope 1, scope 2 and scope 3. So perhaps with materials we need something similar where we've got, you know, the direct use of the materials, and then we've got the indirect drivers of materials. Because if we're not recognizing the interaction between the drivers and the direct consumption or production of materials, we won't be able to solve this problem, I don't think.
Yep.
But you might disagree.
Yep. Someone asks here, should we measure well-being as part of the circular economy, and how would we do that?
It's hard to do, but you can certainly do surveys for well-being. The challenge is that I was looking at this a few years ago, is how do you know, you either have to be very specific about this, like what's the well-being associated with shopping at op shops, for example. You can measure that stuff through surveys, but when you come to an economy-wide well-being index, I mean, you know, you could say, oh, well, during COVID, we reduced consumption, for example, but we might be sadder, you know, because of COVID's happening. So it's really hard to isolate the external factors from the transition of the whole economy. There's just so much going on. So to be able to isolate, like, how much of the improvement or change in well-being is associated with our transition, that's a really hard thing to do at the macro level.
So we've got quite a lot of data on health and social determinants of health. So if you're thinking about well-being from that perspective and the impact of climate change or toxicity, there's a really good precedent there saying, yeah, we should be measuring that. We are measuring some of it. But I think that there's something more, something intangible about well-being. And personally, I'm quite interested in questions around willingness to pay, not so much to say, oh, well, you know, we should be setting a pricing point or charging, although people do use willingness to pay surveys to identify that. It's also a way for people to articulate the intangible value of something. And so I'm quite interested in experimental methodologies around how we might measure well-being in that way.
Yeah. So we're quickly running down the clock now, and I'm inclined to say, Ben, in a couple of sentences, what's the next frontier in circular economy reporting?
Wow. I think the next frontier is enabling those three elements of industry measurement, society, so the well-being measurement and the environmental measurement to come together, Heinz, because that way we can take a more comprehensive view of the ingredients that we all rely on for life, right? And that sounds very philosophical, but we can do this by taking a place-based approach, because that's where communities come together and care. Countries are big things. The globe is a big thing. Regions are where communities are, and I think that's where we can have the biggest impact in a country like Australia.
Yeah. Quick thoughts.
I'm going to be smart and say there is no frontier. It's an open system.
Excellent.
We need all the ideas.
Yes. And?
And I'm going to say the next frontier is what I said earlier, is about integrating metrics into incentives and regulatory frameworks so that they actually translate to tangible action. Otherwise, we risk spending all our energy measuring things that no one pays attention to. And that's very sad.
Yeah. So please thank the panel, Ben, Kate and Kat. I hope this was both informing and entertaining in some way. And I think the lunch break is now going to start.
Thank you, Heinz, as well. Thank you, panel.